Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS Roy, your net control operator for the Limark Technical Net. Limark Technical Net has been going on since 1982 and continues every Sunday night at 8 p.m. We were off last week because of the Jewish holidays, Yom Kippur, but we're back again. And as always, I like to remind people, if you have any comments, if you have any topics, if you have any puzzlers to share, I like to offer puzzlers to the group, or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at a website or a YouTube video or some news about space or space reports that he does, you can contact us via email through mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And if there's any articles that are mentioned or any important topics that have linkable pages, I will put them up on my link page. And you can go just on your web browser, type in roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll land you on the link page. There is a chat room available. You can either get there through Limark's own website, and they have links to it, or you can just type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll take you to the chat room. And as always, I'm hopefully streaming this via the Internet. All you have to do is type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll give you the audio stream. And as always, I like to remind everyone that Mike, AC2NJI, has a website called amateurradio.tv that has archives of the technical net that go as far back as September of 2006. So keep that in mind, and on an odd night or day where you have nothing else to do, check it out and listen to a couple of the archives. The information remains very useful. So let me drop for a second. Okay, as always, I like to give people an idea of what's coming up. We're going to take open questions of any kind of a technical nature at first, and sometime between 8:30 and 9 o'clock, Andy, WA2CDL, will return for another episode of Andy's Corner. He'll be talking about transmission lines and impedance matching with the transmission lines, so that should be interesting. Then I will return at the end of that and take any further general questions or comments, and maybe offer an article or two on a subject, we'll see. And at roughly at 10:15, Paul, WS2N, will have his SpaceNet report. And that'll be until about 11 p.m., and then we will close the net. So, if you would like to get on the list for any technical questions or topics you want to discuss, please give me your first name and your call sign.
KC2, Mike Delta Papa, and Steve.
Steve recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list tonight for any questions or topics of a technical nature? Okay, Rich recognized. Anyone else want to put their name down for tonight? Okay, very well. People will be able to put their name down later if they come up with a question or they come late to the show. Steve, the KC2MDP, what's your question or topic for tonight?
Just let the ad go by there. Good evening to you. Good evening to one and all on the net. I have a question concerning, say, vertical antennas. Is there any advantage to, let's say, you know, a three-quarter wave, five-eighths wave over, you know, a quarter wave or a halfway vertical? I was watching something on the internet that basically said, you know, you get a better takeoff angle with, you know, let's say like a three-quarter wave or a 0.64 wave. Is there any truth to that? Back to you.
Okay, that is a very surprisingly topical question tonight, because one of the people joining us via EchoLink is Jeff AB6MB. He is the new net control operator for the Papa System Antenna Technical Net, and his antenna of the week. He has a TechNet of his own on Friday nights at 7 o'clock Pacific time. That's 11 o'clock our time. And he brought up the concept of 5/8 wave vertical. So I will give you a bit of a gist after I give the repeater a little chance to break. Okay, you'll get a lot of arguments out there because there's pro and con, as in most things. Theoretically, a quarter wave ground plane vertical is a very, very standard design. And so someone had to come up with something a little different and maybe better. And what they did was they extended the vertical from the usual one quarter to 5/8. The problem with that, though, is it introduces a great deal of capacitive impedance and detunes the resonance of the antenna, obviously, because antennas don't want to be these strange little odd portions of a quarter wave. So what you do, and what every designer has done, is place a loading coil at the base. It introduces additional inductance. It neutralizes the capacitance of the 5/8 wave and gives you a resonant real impedance value where you can radiate your energy. The reason why people like to do this is because the output stays the same for the most part, but the distribution changes a little bit. And what you were alluding to is the takeoff angle. When you put a vertical up, there are nodes of increased radiation patterns and decreases. So as you lengthen your vertical from one quarter to 5/8 and then retune it with a loading coil, you will lower the takeoff angle. You will make it more horizontal, which is more beneficial for transmissions, especially line of sight. You don't want to point your radiator straight up at the sky unless you want a near vertical incident sky wave and talk to guys across the street. So the theory is that you get about 3 decibel of gain in the right direction along the horizontal. Let me drop for a second. Now, this is an argument that goes on the band, on websites, and all over the place, because there are many people who rightly suggest that a design of a 5/8 wave introduces a certain degree of loss, whereas a one-quarter wave is resonant without any loading coil. You have to introduce a loading coil. Now, some loading coils are better than others. They all introduce a certain degree of insertion loss. Also, just like a quarter wave, they tend to need a radial system, because basically they're operating sort of as a three-quarters wave. Not mechanically, they're 5/8, but with the loading coil, electronically you're tuning them as though they were a three-quarters wave vertical. So you have to keep that in mind. You need to have a good radial system. You need to have a very low insertion loss loading coil. If you don't, you might lose all of those 3 decibels of gain. So that's the short version of 5/8 wave. And 3/4 sort of works the same way, that you develop these interesting complicated nodes that are thought to be a little bit more beneficial for propagation purposes.
Very good, very good. I'll definitely have to do some experiments with 5/8 3/4. As far as the ground radios, let's say, you know, basic quarter wave, is there a specific length to make the ground radios? And the reason I ask is I picked up one of these, I think it's an MT4, it's like a manually tuned screwdriver antenna. And, they give you a set of ground radials for it, basically 40 through 10 meters. And they kind of work, and, I've done some experiments on my own, and basically having a little bit of trouble tuning this antenna in for, you know, best SWR. They give you this little gauge you're supposed to stick on it, and, you know, a certain position, you know, say 2 inches up is, you know, 10 meters, and maybe, you know, 4 or 5 inches up is 20 meters. And with the ground radios they gave you and the ones I made, you know, I've tried using 3, I've tried using 6, and I get the antenna to tune, but it's nowhere where they suggest it's supposed to be. So is there a magic length for these ground radios I should be using?
I wish there was, because it would make life much easier on the band. That's another point that everyone and their brother has a opinion about, and some are good and some are not so good. And the problem is, with most things, radials can be complicated. The amount of radials that you need for a given vertical antenna are highly dependent upon if it's elevated or if it's on the ground. If it's on the ground, you need a heck of a lot more than 3 radials. Usually people start at 36 and just add more as they get enough wire to do nonsense like that. In the case of ground-mounted verticals, you're doing two different things. You're giving a ground plane so that the antenna monopole is acting as a mirror, and there's an imaginary other monopole on the other side, and it's operating as sort of half of a dipole, which is the way most ground plane quarter waves tend to work. Also, you're shielding the antenna from ground coupling and ground loss, because if you didn't have a strong radial system and it was close to the ground, it would couple the ground and the RF would soak into the ground and warm up the worms, make them very happy but not make you very happy. The length has been all over the place. Some people talk about a quarter wave, which is probably the high end of the length for a given radial. Most people try to make it a little shorter. They make it an eighth of a wavelength, but it's something less than usually a quarter wavelength. If it was a complete quarter wavelength, you basically would just have a dipole in an L configuration, if you think about it.
Okay, very good, very good. Makes sense, yeah. More experiments in the backyard. I also found, too, you know, I took this thing up, you know, played with it real quick. I took it up, you know, on like a backpacking field trip, set it up. I have the tripod for it, and the antenna's probably, I'd say the base of the antenna's maybe 5 feet off the ground. And with the radios they provided, I found I got a better SWR elevating the radials, you know, maybe say 2-3 feet off the ground. If you could just give a, you know, brief what's going on there, it'd be greatly appreciated.
Well, obviously, again, the higher that you raise the vertical antenna away from the ground, and it's relative to the wavelength, so it's highly dependent upon if you're... Most 5/8 waves are UHF, VHF, although I have a 10-meter 5/8 wave. So in those cases, getting it 5, 10 feet off the ground has a significant effect. If it was a lower frequency antenna, it wouldn't really work much. Another option you might want to consider is you can tweak and adjust the impedance not only by changing the number and length of the radials, but by changing the angle that the radials come off of the radiating element. So in other words, in free space, theoretically, a quarter wave ground plane only really puts out 36 ohms of impedance, because it's half the impedance of a full dipole, which is about 76. The trick, though, is if you take the legs of the radials and twist them down to about 45 degrees, the impedance will rise up to about 50 ohms. So you might want to also consider tweaking the angle of the radials if you can.
Yeah, once again, that makes sense. Yes, as I'm lifting them up, yeah, sure, I'm changing the angles of the radials. the funny thing is, though, is the kit they gave you, 20 meters was, was spot on as far as, adjusting it to what they say. And 10 meters, like I said, gave me quite a bit of difficulty. I mean, I could do it, but like I said, it was nowhere in specs as to what they said it should be.
Well, yeah, I mean, as much as we would love the magic multi-band antenna, some antennas simply work better at certain bands. There are other interactions. There's ground coupling that we mentioned. There's coupling with other pieces of equipment nearby. Different antenna designs use different modes for different frequencies. Sometimes it's just multimodal. Sometimes they use traps. And, you know, some are better than others. And I have known people who adjust and change their radios dependent upon what band they really want to use the best. So, you know, by tweaking the length of the radios, that might improve the other band. But it'll cause the first band to suffer. So, you know, there's no free lunch, unfortunately.
Exactly. That's what I've been doing. Basically, they give you the radio kit, and basically, it's the kit they give you is like two different ones. I think one is for 6, 10. I think that might be it, and then the others, to the other bands, which is much longer. I started experimenting, making my own radio sets. One for 10 meters, one for 20, and so forth, and so on. I guess I just got to experiment a little more and tweak these radials, and once I get it fairly good, I'm set, mark them what they are, put them in a little bag, and next time I go up backpacking, I will avoid, half an hour trying to set this for the lowest SWR.
Yeah, it sounds like a plan. By the way, what band does this antenna operate on? Are you talking about the screwdriver or the 5/8?
This is a manual screwdriver. It's Super Antenna makes it. It's the MP1. And I think it's 40 through 10. And you can do 6. You got to take the whip off and play with the screwdriver coil. And it's got an adjustable whip, and I think you can do 2 and 440. It's basically like a telescopic whip that you can play with. And I've tried that, too, and that's another thing with the ground radios, too, is, you make the whip, let's say, 19 inches long, and you try and make the radios about the same, and the SWR is, 2.2, 2.3, somewhere in there. So you start playing with the whip until you get it to, a 1.2, 1.5, somewhere, at least you're, somewhat happy.
Okay, very good. Some people love screwdriver antennas. I mean, the underlying concept behind them is lovely in a simplistic way. It's basically just a mechanically shortened vertical that is electronically lengthened by a variable loading coil at the base, which has, when it was first designed, basically a screwdriver motor assembly that adjusted the tapping point remotely so that you could adjust where it tapped and tune it for different frequencies. The problem with things like that is, again, the fact that the loading coils have some degree of insertion loss, and they can cause efficiencies that are kind of scary in extreme cases. I'm sure you've heard or seen people who have 80-meter mobile antennas that are just these enormous helical coils and a short length of wire. Those things apparently have an efficiency of about 2-3%. I mean, it's not 0%, so it's something. But sometimes the efficiencies are terrible. But as you go up to higher frequencies and you're using less of the inductance, it has a higher and higher efficiency radiation.
Yeah, very good. My old vehicle, I don't have it on this one because I don't feel like punching holes through a brand new car. But my older vehicle, yeah, I had the screwdriver antenna on there. You know, it was a little switch in there, electric motor made it go up and down, had the SWR meter in the vehicle and stuff, and that one worked quite well. Like I said, this one I've only had, you know, maybe a month or so, and I'm experimenting with it, and, you know, it was on 20, and it worked quite well. And 10, like I said, once I got it tuned in, but then again, the bands were dead. 6, the bands were dead. So as far as, you know, the efficiency and how the antenna works, I couldn't say on those bands. Because, like I said, the bands were, you know, completely dead.
Okay, very good. I'm sure you're going to have fun. And come back and tell us what you discover. You know, I think it's MFJ has this this non-motorized version. It basically, it's a loading coil and a whip, and if you need to change your resonant frequency, you have to go over to it. Usually it's kind of designed to mount on a window frame at a 45-degree angle, so you have to start pulling the clip off the inductor and finding the sweet spot on the inductor. So I know people who've used that. That seems like a great deal of effort, but, you know, we do what we have to do. So good luck with that, Steve. If anyone else has any comments about 5/8 or 3/4 wave verticals, please give me your call sign. Okay, nothing much. Steve, with your 5/8, I'm curious, what band is it 5/8 for?
Well, this MP1, I do believe it's a quarter wave, you know, with the helical coil on it. And I was just figuring, you know, I was, you know, on the internet, you know, YouTube, everything else, watching these videos, you know, and this one guy was explaining, you know, the benefits of, you know, 3/8, you know, 3/4 wave, you know, 5/8 wave, as far as the takeoff angle. And I figured, well, you know, they give you a, whatever it is here, I think it's like a 46, 48-inch whip on top of this coil, that if I were to, you know, extend that and basically make this thing a, you know, a 5/8 wave rather than a quarter wave and, you know, try and use it that way, I might get a little bit of, you know, benefit as far as takeoff angles at the horizon.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Theoretically, you can arrange it for that and tap it at a point in the loading coil so that it's effectively something close to a 3/4. It basically, what it amounts to is at 1/4 and all things being equal, it's resonant. Then when you lengthen it more, it becomes inductively reactant until it reaches just before 5/8, and then it suddenly kind of flips over and becomes capacitively more reactive. And then as you bring it up to 3/4 of a wave long, the capacitive reactance drops down to negligible and you're resonant again. So you could try like that. The problem with 5/8 and the reason why 5/8 are popular in UHF and VHF and occasionally in 10 meters is because it introduces a lot more of a pain in the backside mechanical problem. You're now stuck with something that's much bigger than it was before. You know, I mean, it's 5/8 instead of 1/4. So it's a lot more metal, and you have to make sure that it's structurally sound and it's not going to give out in the wind and such. But if you don't have any problems as far as that's concerned, you might as well give it a try. What do you got to lose?
Yeah, exactly. That's the main reason I bought this antenna. It, you know, it folds up, you know, screws. It basically fits in a little bag that's maybe 18 inches long. It weighs absolutely nothing. Yeah, you either throw it in the backpack or you just carry it into the woods, set it up. The tripod's basically the same thing. It's like an ultralight camera tripod. That thing probably folds up maybe two and a half feet. It, once again, weighs nothing. You know, the heaviest thing carrying into the woods is the battery to operate the 817.
What kind of a battery do you use for the 817?
I actually bought a, it's a, it's a lead acid, but it's like a sealed lead acid battery. It's basically for a motorcycle. So it's maybe 4 inches in, you know, in depth by about maybe 6 inches. You know, it's typical, you know, lead acid motorcycle battery. And it probably weighs, I'd say, probably about 5-6 pounds, which isn't really all that bad.
Okay, very good. I mean, lead acid is has been with us for more than 100 years, and it gets the job done. If you're curious, take a look at what's called lithium iron phosphate. Not ion, I-O-N, but iron, I-R-O-N. It's an interesting technology. It has some benefits. The downside, of course, like anything, is it's more expensive. It's about $10 every amp hour. But it allows for a lot more recycles, and it lasts at 13 volts much longer during its charge. Lead acid will slowly drop down from 13 to 12 to 11 to 10 as it discharges. So keep an eye open for lithium iron phosphate, just so you know it's around.
Very good. Yeah, I've seen them. I've seen a YouTube video or something, BioNO or something, and yeah, they were like $200 or something. I think for this one, I paid like $50. And my next project now is I'm trying to. As a matter of fact, I got it in the works now. Is solar panels to recharge this battery, and a small solar panel with the controller and everything else to charge this battery. And in the future, I might go to one of those. The lithium ion or whatever they are. I understand they're a lot lighter too, which would be a great help dragging this thing into the woods.
Yeah, in addition to the number of cycles and the voltage it maintains, they're also significantly lighter than at lead acid batteries. But lead acid, like I said before, works. I have a PowerGate Epic device that switches power dependent upon the situation. It will feed the power supply energy, charge up the backup battery, and it even has a port where you can plug in solar cells so that you can charge up the battery using the solar cells instead of the power supply. So that's a great toy as well. So have fun, enjoy yourself. That's the point of this hobby, in my humble opinion. If you're not enjoying yourself, you're doing it wrong.
Exactly. Like I said, I dragged this thing into the woods over Labor Day weekend. You know, spent 3 days camping out. You know, had more fun. Didn't make one single contact on 10 meters, 6 meters. Didn't make any contacts on 2 or 440. I tried them all. 20 was kind of there. And, I had more fun playing radio than anything else.
Right. That's the point. If you're not having fun, you're doing it wrong. But thanks, Steve, for the question. If anyone has any further comments on this subject, please give me your call sign.
Into extreme under battery.
Yes, Wesley.
I just switched the radio, so I've heard only about the battery, but interesting stuff is if you go to EEV blog on YouTube, number 1340, guy is presenting the new battery of Tesla, which is a small battery, looks like a regular battery for your radio, like a C cell. And he explained how it works. It's 6 times power, 5 times energy, plus 16% of range, in draft. So again, it's on YouTube, EEV blog, number 1340, and the title is New Tesla 4680 Battery Cell Explained. Interesting, simply how it works is, when you have a typical battery, it looks like you have a few layers of one on the top on each other sandwich, and then you roll it up. But when you roll it up and rolling off, and you try to measure the length of it, you're gonna get approximately about 800 millimeters, which is probably around 2.5 feet long. But because the thickness of each one of the layer is in micrometers, so the total sandwich is very small in diameter. Then you roll it up, you have something like a double A battery. Now, interesting is that he found, and I must agree with him, that the 4680 battery, new Tesla battery, that's supposed to be so miraculous, is simply the number stands about the size. So the first one was 1865, which was 18 by 65 millimeters. The other one was 2170, which was 21 times 70 millimeters. And the other one is 46 by 80. That way it's being called 4680. So it means it's twice as big. So because you have a bigger battery, you have a more ability to store the energy in it. Let's go. But interesting in it is absolutely simple, absolutely amazingly simple. When you imagine that electron has to travel along the copper foil for 800 millimeters, it takes a time. So then we talk that you have a energy density, but you don't have a power. So what he did is he put the lead for plus and minus, and not on the left and right side of the sandwich, but he put it on the top of the barrel. And since the sandwich is only tall for 80 millimeters, which is approximately 3/4 of an inch, a little bit more than 1/4 of an inch, then the route from the beginning to the end is only 1/4 of an inch. So now you're getting a power and density with that clever design. Let's go. So Dr. Roy, I really advise you to go for it, because people can make similar battery by themselves and get extremely good performance. Based on the typical batteries, simply unwind it and do the trick which is explained in that video, top and the bottom, just changing the lead, and now you have a much better performance. Enter here.
Well, Wesley, I saw the video, I've seen other videos, I've seen the presentation. The primary benefit, as you mentioned, is simply that the surface area is bigger. They've gone from 18 by 65 to a 46 by 80, and it's just bigger, so it has more layers. They call that jelly rolling. When you put two layers with a dielectric in the middle, and then you roll them into a cylinder. So what they've done, basically, aside from increase just the size of each individual battery, is they've taken it from the standard tabbed manufacturing way, which is you spot weld tabs on one end of the layer on one side of the roll, and the other layer on the other side of the roll, and you feed the power through the tabs, they are increasing the copper outside of the sandwich and bending it over and capping it on one side with copper and the other side with aluminum, and using that as a way of removing the tabs and introducing the idea of thermal transmission by putting metal on the top and the bottom of the cylinders. They're able to dissipate more heat than they can just by blowing air through the cylinder barrels and such. So it's an interesting technology. Unfortunately, they showed absolutely no actual batteries. They showed some pretty pictures, and they do look pretty. I don't think that you or I, maybe you, but not myself, could take apart a lithium iron a lithium ion battery and get the copper on the top to a nice flat edge and figure out how to do it for the aluminum below.
Okay. That's why I suggested you to go to this particular EEV blog, and the rest of the title is New Tesla 4680 Battery Cell Display. Yes, the clever thing is that if you take your lithium-ion battery and you unroll it, and then you take top instead of the side, so the electron has to travel from left to right for the long way, you put it simply on the top and the bottom, and then you bend it over. Now you have the energy density and you have the power. And of course, you might have a little bit problem with the heat, because I don't believe that regular lithium ion batteries is made this way, that they have that small opening like a small tube in the middle of it, so the air can flow from the top to the bottom. I'm not sure about it, but interesting story. It's pretty simple. Entry.
Well, I agree. It's interesting. I don't know if it's simple. I did see, as I said, the video, so I'm well aware of it. I saw pretty much all the stuff that's available out there about it, and it looks like it's going to be interesting. The way that most batteries, cylindrical batteries, have a problem in that their stacking density is not great because they're cylindrical. So, you know, if you had a square battery, it would pack at a higher density. So that's a sort of a problem with cylindrical, no matter what you do. But usually they're cooled by just running cold air across the outer area of it, whereas the cylindrical batteries produce the greatest amount of heat in its center. So a method of tapping the heat through the upper and lower taps of the new technology battery, it means that they'll be able to dissipate heat more effectively.
I would suggest you to look at that particular video again, because you probably might be missing something. I can recall. So let's say you have a certain resistance between the left and right of 800 millimeter length of the sandwich, where you have a top in regular squarish or sandwich battery, or even in the cylindrical battery that is simply winded so it looks like a cylinder. But if you then change the top instead of left and right of the long length of that foil, you put it on the top and the bottom, you actually have the same battery. The only thing is that then you might have about, if I recall properly, 20 milliohm maximum cell resistance, and that allows you to go with 10 amps, and the power loss would be about 2 watts instead of 6-7 watts as it was before. And they have a clever technology for the pore separator, which is poly something. I'm not sure which kind of poly metal it is, but What is happening is when the heat is too much, then that porous material is actually melting and closing the pores. This way it reacts and makes it short. So the cell is short, there is no more reaction, there is no fire. But with the regular lithium ion battery, instead of one top, you can have a few tops all along the length of each one of the outer layers. Let me drop. And we've done that, then you simply bend it over, like you said. Copper, bend it over on the top, and aluminum, bend it over on the bottom. And that's why the same battery actually has a shorter electron travel. And right here.
Yeah, Wesley, by using a tabless design, they're decreasing the length of the current. Instead of the long way, it's going the short way, and so the internal resistance and peak power transfer for this new battery design. So it sounds interesting. Like I said, I did listen to it and watch it. I don't think they went into thermal runaway issues, at least not any part that I can recall. I will, if I have a chance, during other people's segments, post on my link page a link to the EEV blog that discusses it, because it is interesting, and battery technology is evolving almost every hour. So I appreciate you bringing this up to us, Wesley.
Thank you very much. Last question for you is, what makes people do not buy Tesla?
I don't know. Probably right now it's a rather premium product. There are a bunch of people, I'm sure, who are still set in their ways, and they're not quite sure about electronic motor vehicles. And in other cases, it's people trying to rationalize buying the premium price that Tesla has. I'm sure as time goes on, they will get into the lower price margin designs as well. But right now, they're rather expensive.
I agree with you. Do you think that right now, word fancy is not no longer applied to Lamborghini or Rolls Royce or Bentley, but is drifting to something like Tesla?
Well, I think this is kind of apples and oranges. With Tesla, it's probably at least one order of magnitude less expensive than those glorified sports cars. And, I think that's just for people who want to demonstrate that they have that much money to spend on a motor vehicle. So you're still going to get ostentatious people who have mechanical million-dollar wristwatches when an electronic watch is more accurate and can be bought for $20. You're still going to get that group. I think the Tesla is designed more for younger people or more technologically interested people rather than status-seeking people. But, that might change.
Thank you very much for the time given to me.
You're welcome, Wesley. Rich, W2BZ, you checked in, but I was thinking maybe we could go to Andy in Andy's Corner. So we stay tuned, and we'll take your question on the other side.
Most likely still be here, but maybe not, but I'd much rather listen to Andy.
Okie doke. Very good, Rich. Thank you very much. So, it is now once again time for Andy's Corner, WA2CDL. And Andy, what do you got for us tonight?
Oh, here I am. Okay, WA2CDL. I'm looking at the transmit. I didn't hear anything. Yes, I have a lot of stuff. I got a bag of tricks. But it's, I got a sack full of toys, but Christmas is coming. We can guarantee that. Amongst everything else. All right, good evening. I was just muddling over the material that I'm thinking of talking about tonight, because it's been a few weeks. And what happens is, even myself, I have a tendency to forget, you know, where I left off. And I started talking about impedance matching, the transmission lines, and we got into standing wave ratio, and so on and so forth these past few weeks. So here I am, trying to catch up and see where we left off. Now, I will say the reason why I was talking about impedance matching is because there is an article in QST, which I have yet to read. I have not read it yet, meaning I didn't read it on the air so everyone can, you know, listen and follow along. It's in November 2019's QST, and it's by Ward Silver, N0AX, and it's about impedance matching with transmission lines. So this is, he explains how, you know, to use transmission lines to convert impedances. And a couple of things I got to remember is not to time it out. So I'm going to try to keep the transmission short. But before I get into this QST article, which I have yet to get into, I was talking a little bit about coax cables and their properties and how they work and what they do and so on. And I think the last time I was on, which was a few weeks ago, I was talking about transmission lines as circuit elements. I believe that's the section in this particular book that I'm reading from. That's where I left off. So I'm gonna review that again. I figured before I get into this QST article, because it's been a few weeks, you know, the way I've been doing these segments, it's been a continuing segment from, as one ends, yet another one begins. But it's a continuous stream, so I think I'm going to do that tonight. And so I'll review what...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Yeah, see, it's a good thing I'm listening to myself. So I just time it out. So I'll break this up. Let's see, 10 to 9. I got about 40 minutes or so. I'm going to work tomorrow. Sometimes I don't go to work, sometimes I do. And that's physically going to work. I work from the house also. But tomorrow I got to go into work, so I can't stay up. Can't stay out or up too much longer. So, all right. And I'll be stopping along the way, you know, if anybody has any questions. So, here's the review of transmission lines and circuit elements that I spoke about once before, and that was a few weeks ago, and I'll just repeat it again as a review for anyone who is still listening to this or is new and hasn't heard this at all. So, so here we go, and let me just let it drop and I'll start. All right, so basically, you know, a transmission line, and we're talking about coax cable in this particular case. Everybody knows what coax cable is because they've used it. But there's other types of transmission lines. There's open wire, there's a lateral line, I forget the others, but there's a few that it mentions. But we're dealing with coax cables in this particular case. So, a section of transmission line can be made, and I'm just reading this, by the way, so people can follow along. I'm reading this out of not QSD, this is another book that I have. A section of transmission line can be made to act as a circuit element by taking advantage of the standing wave pattern along the line. Okay, so you have learned that the input impedance of a transmission line is subject to wide variation along its length when it is not matched. So you got to keep that in mind when it's not matched. In fact, the input impedance can be high or low, resistive, reactive, or a combination of resistive and reactive. you know, expressing the same thought differently, a transmission line can be made to act as a capacitor, an inductor, a resistor, or a combination of circuit components. It can also be made to have the characteristics of a series resonant circuit or a power resonant circuit. And we all know that, you know, in a series resonant circuit, and just a qualification, at resonance, the capacitive and inductive reactances cancel, and you have a low impedance. You have a high current flow, because the only resistance you have is the resistor itself, if there is a resistor. In a power resonant circuit, it's just the opposite. You have a high impedance across the power resonant circuit, and that's because of the property of the capacitor being charged by the inductor as the magnetic field collapses, which recharges the cap, and it has a back and forth effect. So it draws very little current from the line. The line current is low, which means the impedance is high, because when you have a high current, you have a low impedance. When you have a low current,
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Now I gotta catch myself on the timeout. So again, when you have a high current, you have a low impedance. And when you have a low current, you have a high impedance. So as I just said, this coax cable we're talking about that has a high standing wave at the end of the line, and that's because either the line could be shorted or opened. It's not terminated in its characteristic impedance. So what the characteristics will depend on would now be the line length and the termination. So the line length is now important, because we're not terminated in its characteristic impedance. Let's say with the 50 ohm line, then you have to have a 50 ohm load, and then of course you won't have the same characteristics that we're describing. So if a transmission line is cut to the correct length to correspond to an electrical half wavelength at the frequency of the generator, standing wave patterns, such as shown in this particular figure, occur. So this is this will be a half wave length piece of cable. That's going to be at the frequency, and it's of course the half wave of the frequency that you're applying to it, because every frequency has a certain wavelength. And this will occur when the line is open. This is for an open line. So then they show it in a figure. So when it is open, it constitutes a very high impedance, which means the high impedance is the current is at minimum, but the voltage is at maximum. And again, you have to really see the figure to understand that the current and voltage, when the current is at minimum, the voltage is at maximum. And just like a dipole antenna, because at your feed point, you know, where you're feeding the dipole, you have a high current at the feed point, and because your impedance is low. As most of you people know, a dipole has, in free space, a feed point impedance of about 70-something ohms, 72, 73 ohms, around there, for a half-wave dipole. So that's at the feed point. At the end of the line, your...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Yeah, I just hate these timeouts. WHCDO, let me let it drop. All right. So as I said, the impedance at the feed point is low, and that means your current is high, and your current is high and your voltage is low, is at minimum. but at the end of the dipole, your voltage is at maximum and your current is at minimum. It's just the opposite, because it's a half wave long, and that's a half wave is like a quarter. It means it's a quarter wave on each side. The total length being a half wave dipole. All right, let it drop. So, what they do here is they call voltages and currents, they call them loops and nodes. When you have a high voltage, it's called a loop. So voltage maximum or voltage loop and a current minimum or current node, so they call a current node and a voltage loop, just to designate, you know, which one is which. So a voltage maximum or voltage loop and a current minimum or current node also exists at the input of the line. So thus, the generator, you know, with the generator looking into the line, sees a high impedance. In other words, the half wavelength line has repeated the open circuit impedance of the termination. Because it's open, it's an open circuit, and it's a half wave, so you're going to, you know, recreate the high impedance at the termination at the end of the line, which is open. It's an open circuit. The generator is going to see that. The reason why I'm mentioning all this again is because, getting back to this article, it says impedance matching with transmission lines. They're actually using certain wavelength lines tied together to now transform impedances. And it says use transmission lines to convert impedances. So this is the reason why I'm mentioning this, you know, because it gives an overview of what this article with QST is going to be talking about, you know, when I get to it. So again, it's just a refresher that I'm going over. So let it drop. All right, there's a bunch of diagrams here, but I can't explain the diagrams. The voltage and current waves along one line are shown above, and the waves on the other line are shown below, so they show a diagram of it. So that's with the line open. Now we're going to take the same transmission line, we're going to short it. We're going to put it short at the end, which also is going to cause a high SWR. When your line is open and your line is shorted, you're going to have a very high SWR. You're going to get reflections on the line. See, it's these reflections that we're taking advantage of in the first place. Because if your line is terminated in the impedance, you're not going to see it's not going to have the reflections, and you're not going to be able to transform the way it is. So we're taking advantage of lines that are of different wavelengths that are either open or shorted, or anything in between. It's not terminated in its own impedance. It's terminated in some other impedance. So if the line transmission, or I should say termination, is shorted, the opposite standing wave condition develops. So, and it's interesting how it does it. In this case, the termination is a short circuit and has an extremely low impedance. So a half-wave line, again, repeats the impedance at the input so that the generator works into a very low short circuit impedance. So in other words, the generator is now going to see a low impedance because you're a half-wave length away from it. We're talking about half-wave lines. So a half-wave repeats whatever is at the end of the line. The half wave will repeat that at the generator end where the signal's coming from. And that's always true. And that's a given. So a constant. Alright, let it drop. Okay, again, they're showing a diagram here. The wave on one line is shown above and the other is shown below. Okay. So no matter what value of load resistance is used, and that's, you know, between the short and open circuit values. So again, you know, keep in mind you got either an open circuit or a short circuit or any load in between, any resistance, okay, for the termination. the input impedance of the line assumes the identical value. So, you know, let's say you have a 65 ohm load. So you're going to have a 65 ohm input impedance. Because you're putting a 65 ohm load on a 50 ohm transmission line.